Even standing still, Ray Welter's body remained in motion and subject to intertidal forces beyond his control. The rain felt more like the idea of wetness than anything resembling drops, and it made its way inside his coat and new boots. Everything ached. He struggled to recall with any certainty what the word dry referred to. The rain fell upward. He wanted to cry. The journey had been a 36-hour nightmare spent suffocating in an airplane seat, riding in a bus on the wrong side of the road, sailing and hitchhiking, and he still had to wait for what looked like a 5-minute ride over to the Isle of Jura. A talkative, red-faced woman had dropped him off at the ferry terminal. "You might as well give me that fancy wristwatch of yours," she had said. "You certainly won't be needing it out here." At least that's what he thought she said. The accent would take some getting used to. He stood at the very precipice of the wired world. The air tasted fresher than anything he had ever sucked into his Chicago-polluted lungs. His pores worked to rid themselves of the poisons of his previous life, and he shivered from the sweaty underclothes, yet some source of heat rose to his face. Across the sound, a ferryman attended to his duties on the deck of a blue-green boat big enough to tote maybe a dozen cars. Jura was so close. Overheated and shivering at the same time, Ray now understood why that island was among the least populated of Scotland's Inner Hebrides. No direct public connection existed from the mainland. He carried with him only an elaborate backpack and a suitcase that contained the sum of his worldly possessions. He wandered along the waterfront and awaited the next-to-last leg of the journey. One of Isla's 6 whiskey distilleries loomed over the ferry port, but he couldn't discern the presence inside of bodies or spirits. It looked deserted, without as much as a gift shop where he could buy a carry-out bottle. A sip of scotch would have tasted so perfect. Over on the inert boat, the ferryman moved slowly and without obvious purpose or motivation, oblivious to the weather. A row of squat houses boasted the greenest lawns on the God's green earth. Swing sets and seesaws of molded plastic punctuated the grass with happy colors. All of Scotland was green, even greener than the springtime prairie back home, back at his former home. Out here, Ray discovered a new shade of green. The acrid smell of burning peat from the chimneys taunted him with the promise of warmth. The hardened mud substitute they used for heat on the islands gave off a strange scent, almost like wood smoke, but more earthy and bitter. He sat against the empty whiskey casks stacked on the stone embankment. The seat of his jeans was already soaked through. He unpeeled the last of his bananas and found it impossible to believe that he had purchased the bunch just that morning. The fluorescence of the supermarket in Oban and the colors of the brightly packaged goods in endless rows glowed in memory as if from a distant universe. Ray dropped the peel into the outer pocket of his pack and took a long drink of mineral water that tasted like sidewalk chalk. A blue van approached, its windows clouded inside, and he pulled to a stop a few yards from where he sat. The driver flashed his high beams, and in reply, the ferryman brought the motor to life. A sad-looking girl emerged from the van. She opened an umbrella and buried her face in her backpack, in her paperback, the title of which he couldn't make out. The vehicle reversed course and retreated toward Bamore. The rear lights glistened red in the wet pavement, and only then, and with some regret, did Ray realize how quiet it had been. Other than the wind and the rain, he hadn't heard a sound. No cars, no airplanes, no loud cell phone conversations. It had never before occurred to him that real silence might be possible. He hadn't even recognized it until it disappeared, the victim of the ferry's mechanical roar. Man-made noise was one of many new absences that he hoped would define his stay out here. He was now officially in absentia from his previous life and ready to begin a new one. The freedom was daunting, but he was up to it. He had to be. He stood, and the ground rolled beneath him like a choppy concrete sea. Exhaustion had crept into his thighs and lower back. His throat remained parched from the dry airplane and miles of hiking. That first whiskey was going to taste so good. The girl hiding inside the hood of her raincoat didn't hear him approach, so when he asked, "What are you reading?" she flinched, and her book landed in a puddle. The ferry pulled to a stop long enough for Ray to follow her aboard. Up close, the ferryman looked older than time itself. "You must be our Mr. Welcher. Right on time, too, I'd say." He pointed to the back of his wrist, but he wasn't wearing a watch. The girl looked up from her now wet paperback. It was Freud on the cover, long enough to flash Ray the evil eye. He gave the ferryman the fare and regretted he had not brought an obol to pay him with. "Call me Ray," he said, and shook the man's hand. No cars or other passengers climbed aboard. "The name's Singer. We got a lot of people out here looking for Orwell. Sounds like you're serious, though. Let me take care of business here if you're going to make it in time for supper." The boat coughed black smoke into the mist. The motors surged, and the ferry, powered by some combination of crowbars, buzzsaws, and garbage can lids, backed away from Isla. The motion mimicked Ray's vertiginous balance, and the volume of the engine dislodged some black bile from the back of his throat. That's the first time I ever got vertiginous right, by the way. Twice. A slave driver down in the galley kept time with a pair of monkey wrenches. He banged on a kettle drum full of rusty screws. The vibration found its way to Ray's backbone. The stink of diesel fuel filled his sinus cavity. He would never be still or dry ever again. Only motion existed now. The boat moved, and Ray was carried by a series of systemic forces. He paced in circles, port to starboard, starboard to port, while the boat defied the sound's pull, itself directed by the moon. Gravity held him and the ferry and the captain and the sea fast to the spinning earth, which carried all of them around a sun, the existence of which was now speculative. A rivulet of mineral water curled its way through his digestive tract and into his circulatory and respiratory processes, while the pouring rain sought every millimeter of exposed flesh. Even with the ferry nearing the shore, or the shore nearing the ferry, Ray still felt like he might never make it to Jorah. Zeno's paradox would take over. He would continue to travel half the distance, and then half of that, and half of that, and the closer he got, the more he felt his body shutting down. Famine, dehydration, and fatigue nipped at his heels. Marshmallow-like mucus colonized his chest, and bits of it escaped up his throat every time he coughed. He held onto the railing to maintain what remained of his balance. The motion of the boat felt too familiar now, as did the wind, which reminded him of Chicago. The brat schoolgirl kept her eyes buried in her wet copy of Civilization and its Discontents. The ferry stopped, and there became here. He had made it. Singer lowered the plank, and Ray stepped foot upon the Isle of Jura. The air was rich and clean, but he still had to hoof it several miles. He had received the directions via email. From the ferry port, Jura's only paved road curled around the southern butt of the island and then ran two-thirds of the way up the eastern coastline to Craig House, which sat in the mouth of the bay and faced the Scottish mainland. He would pick up some supplies at the Jura stores, which was owned by the same couple who would serve as his landlords for the next 6 months. Then he would hitchhike 25 miles up toward the northern tip to Barnhill, the estate where George Orwell wrote 1984. That was where Ray would begin his new life. It was still difficult to believe. Before donating his laptop to a Buddhist temple on the north side, he had searched online for rental properties on Jura, but never imagined that Orwell's very own house would be available. The rental agent he reached in Glasgow said he was very lucky that he phoned when he did. Barnhill was fully furnished, she had said, and would comfortably sleep 8. The rental had cost him every last dollar that remained in his own name, but getting off the grid for half a year would be worth any expense and hassle from Helen and her junta of divorce attorneys, even with the knowledge that when the lease expired, he would be flat broke and have no place to live. The girl pushed past Ray and climbed into the cab of an old flatbed truck. Bagpipe music blared from the radio, and he couldn't figure out if the effect was meant to be ironic. The driver leaned toward the passenger side door and rolled down the window. He had a perfectly round head with a bulbous nose and slack double chin. His hair buzzed down to a military-style flat top. "You welter?" he yelled. "Yeah." "Then get in here." The girl squeezed over so Ray could climb inside. The bagpipes might have been used for interrogational purposes. "Ray Welter," he said, holding out his hand. The cab smelled of rancid meat and whiskey. Exceptional whiskey. After purchasing a few odds and ends, Ray dozed off and was awoken when the truck stopped and he was all but shoved out the door. A trail led down a little embankment from the dirt road to Barnhill, which sat nestled in a pocket of lower ground between the ridge and a series of hills along the shoreline. The structure had been built on a protrusion into the Sound of Jura, and water surrounded it on three sides. There were no other dwellings in sight. His only neighbors were the countless sheep whose wet wool floated in puffy clouds over the mud. Jura had more of them than the nighttime sky had stars. There had to be hundreds of them clustering in packs, large and small. The front door pushed open and led to a small mudroom. The smell of mildew and garbage punched him in the gut. He put off touring the premises and instead made several trips back up to the truck where Pitcairn sat smoking a cigarette and reading his newspaper. The boxes of supplies filled the small mudroom and half the foyer. The whole house stank. After Ray carried the last of his things inside, he leaned out the door and waved goodbye to Pitcairn, who left a cloud of noxious exhaust behind. The bagpipes died a slow and painful death until, like that, Ray was alone. The wind stirred the trees. The water splashed against the rocks. There existed no human noise whatsoever. Unseen birds welcomed him from the hedges. Wind rippled in waves through the high grasses. He paused for a moment and then removed his boots in the mudroom. Ray was actually in George Orwell's house. It was difficult to imagine, but Orwell had lived and had written 1984 right here. He had paced these very floorboards, watched the sound absorb the rain through these same windows. Going into the sitting room was like stepping back in time. The technological world didn't exist here yet. It was glorious, but Ray had work to do. Some kids had broken in, or more likely had let themselves in through the unlocked front door, and thrown a vomitive party in the sitting room. The stench was unbearable. The hardwood floor sparkled with broken wine bottles. Candy wrappers, beer cans, and old newspapers were strewn everywhere. The two fireplaces at either end of the house would provide his only heat. The physical reality of Barnhill taught Ray something extraordinary about 1984. He now understood the psyche of the novel's hero, Winston Smith, who would eventually give up his resistance and fall in line with Big Brother. Ray had never appreciated what a cold and murky world Smith lived in. He was oppressed just as much by his material conditions as by any direct interaction with the authorities. The faulty victory cigarettes, tear-inducing victory gin, were as destructive to one's well-being as a threat of a visit from the thought police. Were Smith's bathroom tiles as devoutly stained as these? Did the toilet tank in his apartment gurgle constantly like this one did? The initial step toward making Barnhill livable involved trying to get a fire started. A door from the kitchen led to an uninsulated well room now used for storage. It contained what appeared to be several metric tons of peat, which someone had gone to the trouble of cutting into bricks and stacking in a crisscross pattern. Depending on how fast it burned and how cold the house would get at night, it might be enough to warm one room for the duration of his stay. He carried an armful of peat bricks back to the sitting room and fed the least toxic pieces of the partygoers' leftover garbage to the pot-bellied stove that filled the fireplace. He placed three peat bricks on top and lit the newspaper with a match. The room filled with black smoke. It bellowed from the stove in waves. When his panic subsided, he opened the windows and flapped his arms to cajole the smoke outside. Then he remembered the flue. A metal crank on the side of the stove turned with some reluctance. The smoke rose from the fire and went up the chimney only to displace a nest of birds that had settled in the stovepipe but were now rendered homeless. Orwell had rubbed his own hands warm by this fireplace. Ray could just picture it. He swept the swirling dust storms out the door and dumped the contents of his suitcase and backpack onto the sitting room floor. The clothes smelled like they wanted nothing more than to provide a loving home for some colorful mold. He threw the shirts he would need right away over some dining room chairs, which he dragged, scraping across the floor, closer to the dancing fire. The smell of the peat made its way into his sinuses and hair. He ripped the new shirts and shorts from their packages and threw the cardboard inserts into the fire. Once some warmth returned to his fingers and toes, Ray took a walk outside to inspect the property before it got any darker. The garage contained a small number of unusual tools and implements, all neatly arranged. He found pumps, motors, a roll of barbed wire, a sealed oil drum filled with some kind of liquid, sheets of plastic and canvas tarps. A wooden crate contained a length of rope, along with a set of frayed jumper cables, and the largest spider outside of an Atomic Age monster movie. On one side of the house sat a small garden suitable for planting vegetables, if he could keep the wandering sheep away from them. The animals had the run of the island. They had bells around their necks and jingled as they walked. There were also fruit and nut trees he couldn't identify. Maybe Orwell had planted them. Ray fastened a rope between two of them and draped an armful of wet shirts and pants over it. Then he peeled off everything he had on and hung his sweaty clothes on the line. He stood there, naked and fully exposed to the wilderness and the weather. The cold air and steady mist no longer bothered him, and he started to laugh, and then he kept laughing until he couldn't breathe. The water in the distance looked so inviting. Someday soon he would go for a swim. More water fell from the sky. He stomped his feet in the mud. Some tense beast inside his belly spotted an exit and went tear-assing for it. His body felt completely relaxed and at ease. He jumped up and down in the biggest puddles he could find, still laughing, splashing, shouting. For a full hour, Ray ran in circles around the garden. He danced and sang and wiggled his arms in the air above his head. He ran to the top of the hill and rolled. He literally rolled back down toward the house, the hair on his chest and groin picking up burrs along the way. Then he jogged back up and did it again. He rubbed wet earth into the new cuts and scrapes that found their way onto his arms and legs. The mud soon camouflaged every inch, but he piled more onto his head, into his hair. He was transformed. The rain ran down his chest in brown rivers. He stayed outside until the faintest sunlight reflected on the hills. The wind picked up even further and made gentle sweeping noises in the trees. His clothes flapped like a series of personal flags. He had declared independence. When the coldness found his skin, he wiped some of the filth from around his eyes. He was eager to pour a whiskey and warm up again by the fire. He headed back to the house, but stopped at the front door. A dead animal sat crumpled on the stoop where a welcome mat might go. It could have been a squirrel or a small possum, impossible to say. It was more than dead. It had been eviscerated. Its exposed entrails sat coiled in a greasy pile on the top step, still steaming. Some larger creature had moments ago sliced this thing open, crept to the house, and left it at the door as a kind of offering or threat. It was at that moment that Ray felt something watching him. Maybe it was just the exhaustion, the jet lag, or whatever, but he felt something, a palpable animal presence, denser than the bushes in which it stirred. Two glossy eyes flickered at him close to the ground, and then we're gone.